Hey everybody, welcome back to the Ones Ready podcast. You're in the team room, and today we are graced with the Tomahawk 1, I'm going to call you, because you are the commander of the 16th Weapon Squadron, Blitz Norman. I appreciate you joining us.
You bet, Peaches. Thanks for the invite. When I told my wife and kids that you were going to interview me, they said, "You?" I said, "Well, thanks for the vote of confidence, yeah. But honored to be a part of this, so thank you."
No, absolutely, and thanks for taking the time out of your day, because I know as the commander, you are busy, and we just got back. We have had a full-on day of visitations from higher level leadership and senior leader engagements.
Yep. So heavy lazy crown.
Right there. So I don't imagine you set out when you're in high school to become Tomahawk 1. Didn't even know what Tomahawk 1 was.
Yeah.
But so what brought you into the Air Force then?
Yeah. Well, so I didn't even set out to be Tomahawk 1 a couple months ago, because I never thought this opportunity would be real. Ever since I was little, Peaches, I wanted to fly an airplane. My parents weren't aviators. Military service skipped a generation for me, but I'd watch this movie, I'm sorry to say, called Top Gun.
Yep.
I would watch like 5 or 6 years after it was produced, and I thought that looked pretty cool. And then growing up, I wanted to be all sorts of stuff, but the constant thread was I wanted to fly airplanes. You know, want to be a lawyer, fly airplanes. Want to go be a firefighter, fly airplanes. And so that was kind of the consistent thing. Then we got to high school, and then that's kind of where it became pretty serious for us. From the great state of Ohio, go Bucks. I was either going to follow my big brother's footsteps to Ohio State and hopefully long snap for them like he did, or I was going to go out to Air Force and give it a try. So I only interviewed for Air Force. I only put my application out to the academy. And fortunately, my paperwork fell through the cracks, which will be probably a theme of the next hour.
Interesting.
And got picked up. And then shortly thereafter, I got accepted to Ohio State. So as a senior in high school, it was go off to school with your best friend who's 2 years older than you and your brother, or go out and give the academy a shot. And that's a once in a lifetime opportunity. So fortunately, I was able to go out there and was blessed enough to be able to long snap out there and play ball, which I don't think if I didn't, I probably wouldn't have stayed, quite honestly, because it was pretty rough. And then we went to UPT, and I knew I wanted to fly fighters, and a lot of effort, probably some God-given ability potentially, but certainly a lot of effort. And then, again, I just fell through the cracks, was able to get the T-38s and fell through the cracks again, and F-16, and you blink, and 12, 13, 14 years later, here we are. So
yeah, so it was definitely a calling for you then.
Yeah,
I would say that it's probably rare that a lot of people feel that. I mean, sure, you get drawn to something, maybe early on, or at least something kind of interests you, but to know that early on that it's like, I'm going to be a pilot.
Yeah, what was interesting was I had never been on an airplane until I started the enrollment package to Air Force. So I had no idea if I was going to be airsick, if I'd even enjoy it. And so again, I'm a Roman Catholic by faith, and I believe God's providential. So, just everything lined up for a reason. And it turns out if I hadn't have done this, I would have never met my wife. So it worked out. Now we're blessed with 4 kids. And so it is all in all, it's been awesome. Other than there's a tax for everything.
Yeah.
We're a couple thousand miles away from the great state of Ohio and from mom and dad, my brother and his wife and his kids and the extended family. But all in all, it's awesome. So I wanted to join to fly. I now stay to do things bigger than flying, and that's getting to work with elite people like you and the Tomahawks and the Weapon School. So, it's been awesome.
Well, I think that's probably a theme across most people that are serving now, especially when they've been in as long as we have. So you said something there that I keyed in on, and it's something that, I said it, I got this barrel. I was telling you that I got this from speaking at an event, and I kind of try and highlight it every time I go somewhere, almost as a closing is, be appreciative for what the Air Force is giving you. And that's a mixture of things from soft skills of learning how to navigate personalities, different work centers, different situations, the professional skills that as a tactician, whatever your profession is, the places you get to go, the experiences you get to get, and I think probably the most important, or at least maybe the most meaningful, are the people that you get to meet, because not only will they end up becoming lifelong friends that will ebb and flow out of your life, but like, just like me, I got stationed in England and I met my wife. There's no way I would have met, I would have had no business living in England.
That's right.
Without the Air Force. But now I've got two amazing kids out of it. Yep. I've got an amazing wife out of it. And then, you know, and then you, meeting your wife,
yep,
in the path that you went. And it's just, I think little decisions you make, and maybe they're larger decisions, but can take you in a direction. And maybe I didn't go out a night on Cambridge,
yeah,
and meet my wife.
That's right.
Yeah, it's just those things kind of pile up. And then when you take a step back and you look at it, you're like, whoa, so much could be different. Who knows where I would be or what I'd be doing if I didn't make a handful of those decisions.
And I mean, that's true even in the course of a sortie or a mission that we fly. You know, if you decide to, you know, push across the Marshall limit line at X time, you're going to see a wildly different threat picture in front of you than, it, say, you pushed 5 or 10 minutes later. That's true across our career. I mean, mm-hmm, every decision we've made, as it turns out, is significant. You just don't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. But looking back, you do.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you could take it all the way back to a car accident or something.
That's
like
right.
That, where you're like, man, if I had just left the house 2 minutes earlier or 2 minutes later, could have made all the difference.
That's right. You know? That's right.
So, was it always Vipers that you wanted to fly?
Yeah, so I knew I wanted a fighter. I wanted to go fast. I wanted to pull Gs, wanted to shoot missiles and drop bombs if I could. And then out of our T-38 class, we had an F-16, an Eagle, now since retired, obviously. And then we had a FAPE and a B-52. And I was fortunate enough to end up in a position where I got to go to the F-16 and wouldn't trade it for the world.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it was, have you had a backseat ride?
Yes, I have. Okay, I have, yeah, a couple of them.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Got a Viper up there.
Well, it was the old Black Widows.
Yeah, that's
that
right.
I was out there supporting in Bogger back in 2016, something like that.
And that's what's great about the Viper. You know, I mean, in our syllabus here at Weapons School, as your audience may or may not be aware, you know, it's about 6 months long. We do every mission set that there is in the Air Force, short of the Sandy mission. Now, at some point, we may be tasked with it, depending upon what happens with the A-10, obviously, but... you know, so you're flying the dogfighting, the BFM, and then 4 or 5 months later, you got the bombs falling off, mm-hmm, of it, and you're strafing SAMs. And so looking back on it, I wouldn't trade it for the world. Yeah, everyone wanted the Raptor and its capable airframe and stuff like that. Just happened to not be in my drop. And in reality, no disrespect to Slap and the bros upstairs, but I'm glad it wasn't, because we are right where the Lord wants us to be. So,
well, I, you know, Vice, Colonel Fallon,
yeah,
you know, is a prior Viper guy.
That's right.
Pretty much a career Viper guy, now an F-35.
Would he admit that, though?
I don't know. But we're gonna have him on. So
perfect.
At some point. So we'll leave that up to, yeah, him. But he has said a couple things to me, and I never really thought about it this way, at least in terms of the Viper. But I mean, because in terms of mobility, everybody touts the C-130 as being the workhorse of the Air Force.
Yep.
But when it comes to the fighter community, the F-16, unless I'm mistaken, and you know, I'm no expert, seems to be the workhorse of the fighter community. I mean, it is the blue collar.
Yeah.
You know,
lunch pail.
Yeah.
Lunch pail.
And you had already alluded to it. That's everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah. And so I'm biased. So I would agree with you that this is a workhorse. But I think when you look at what we do, we can't afford to be elite in just one mission set. It's awesome. The F-22s and the Eagles before them got to be the subject matter experts on all things air to air. And that's great. We knew our air-to-air stuff, and we know it, but not to the degree that the 433rd does, obviously, in those pure air-to-air squadrons. The A-10, no one in the world will perform CAS like the A-10. Not before the A-10, not after the A-10. The A-10 is the ultimate CAS platform. But we can do CAS pretty good, too. Mm-hmm. You know, SEED, theoretically, the F-35 is going to go and take that mantle from the F-16, which will be great for the force, and they'll do great. But we do SEED pretty well, too. And so that whole jack of all trades, master of none, platitude for sure. But I do think it applies, because we are pretty good across all those mission sets. But what is without a doubt, we can't do it without the help of anybody else. So, you know, we can't get to the Marshall because we don't have a whole lot of fuel without a tanker. We can't fight the error picture without the AWACS or the CRC to tell us what's out in front of us. We can't fly a seed without the help of Intel telling us this is what the threat picture looks like before we get there. We can't fly CAS without the bros on the ground doing the Lord's work for us, right? So we take that very seriously of we better be integrators because we can't do any of this stuff by ourselves.
But that's a common thread across the Air Force and the DoD. You know, there's things in the Pacific that we can't do unless we have the Navy.
That's right.
And everybody complements each other, and that's
To say nothing of the airman that's working in the MPF.
Yeah.
That's making sure you got your orders to show up. That makes sure that your UMD's tight. The maintainers, front shop, back shop, the whole nine, sustainment, like we just were talking about, right? I mean, it takes everyone, and we embrace that inside of our little pointy nose because we're so limited with what we can do by ourselves, but we're still pretty good at it.
Well, and you could walk the dog on that quite a bit, you know, just from JTAC on the ground, troops to contact, call them back, you know, you're getting a scramble, right?
So that's right.
You're scrambling to the jet that the maintainers
that's right.
maintain, the crew chief, the expediters, the pro soups got going, the POL fueled it.
That's right.
You're being taxied thanks to air traffic controllers.
That's right.
Right? You're getting vectored by the air battle space managers.
That's right.
Right? And now you're probably getting tanked by the ones.
There's the little T-Rex arms, yeah, little T-Rex wings. Yeah.
The little lawn darts flying, you know? And so all of that has to happen in order to get effects on the ground. And I think that's one of the things that the Air Force has struggled with is that connecting all airmen to the mission. And then, and of course it starts well before that scramble call. You know, we talked about finance, we talked about security forces. Like, you know, I can't focus on the mission downrange if I'm worried about paying bills.
That's right.
My wife and my kids are getting an eviction notice, so they can't buy groceries because I haven't been paid. So thank you, finance,
for
squaring that away. Security forces ensuring that not only are we safe on the post that we're at in the FOB, but how about back here
making everyone back sure home. That, that's right?
You know what I mean? So it's definitely a team sport that oftentimes I think as an Air Force we kind of miss connecting everybody to it.
And I think it goes both ways too, quite honestly. So, you know, there's a stigma that operators that were prima donnas, then there's a stigma on the other side that, you know, the non-operators, for lack of a better term, you know, aren't at work because of training days, whatever the case may be. So it goes both ways. We need to do a better job as operators understanding the way that our non-operators are grinding and are working their tails off and just relentless effort every day. Likewise, to your point, I do think that the non-operators need to see how they directly influence mission execution. And I think, you know, big ship, small rudder is the platitude with culture and stuff, but I think if we can get closer to linking the airman that is keeping us secure at the front gate all the way to launch an air power, that would be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That would be awesome. And maybe it is happening. Maybe we just don't see it.
You know, yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
It's very likely we don't see it. And that's, you know, you kind of enter into silos depending on you're at. And, you know, I get farther and farther disconnected from the mission, you know, almost every day just by nature of where I'm sitting, you know, in the way that the Air Force is structured.
Yeah.
You know, your chiefs aren't going to be out hacking the mish. You know, or if we do.
But I'd follow you, though. But I'd follow you.
Give me the chance.
Please believe.
I'm out there doing it. But so that kind of comes with a maturity level, I think, and experience level of experience everything. Because I for sure was kind of guilty of that early on, just going like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, we are the mission, especially when you start talking about you know, GWAT and stuff like
that's
that. It's like, we are just deploying on the road. And you kind of get in that grind. It's like, well, I'm out here getting shot at every day, getting blown up. While there's folks that are back there and they're complaining. What are you complaining about? You know, and it's a maturity thing. And it's a level of experience that ends up, I think, kind of changing that thought process.
Yeah. And quite honestly, probably charity, you know, the virtue of charity, will and the good of another, you know, It is very easy to lose your sense of humility, which will then lose your sense of charity for other people. You know, and you know, there might be that person who wants to be an operator, but just based off virtue of an eyesight limitation or something like that, just couldn't meet the min qualifications required to enter, you know, and it doesn't make operators any better. It doesn't make non-operators any worse. Again, we're on the same playing field, just trying to hopefully fly, fight, and win, you know, if it comes to it.
Yeah. Team America. That's what we're trying
Let's
to do.
Let's go.
So as we kind of talk about that maturity and that growth, yeah. Like what would you say, whether they're mistakes you've made or whether sure. you see mistakes being made, like as a young officer corps, what are some of those mistakes that you have made or you've seen made?
Yeah. So as a CAF, as a Combat Air Force operator, we are unique, especially from our sister services, to where we don't really have a whole lot of enlisted airmen that are around us in our squadrons.
Mm, okay.
You know, so I mean, in any given fighter squadron, you're going to have 20 to 25 company grade officers, maybe a couple field grade officers and a squadron commander. Then you might have 2, 3, 4 enlisted personnel with you. And so you already kind of jump out to where you already have the common heartbeat of the squadron is about 23, 24 years old, as opposed to 18 or 19. So I think that's significant in terms of the maturity or lack thereof that you see initially inside our squadron. So I would say I'm starting to get to the point right now to where I've been given the charge and the responsibility and the authority to make sure that I can meet Colonel Fallon's vision of what the F-16 weapons squadron needs to do. That brings a whole different set of challenges, likely outside of just the operational realm, that I've seen for my previous 14 years of service. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So what I would say is mistakes that we see early on in a career are generally, for the most part, or something you do inside the jet or something that you do in the tactical level of warfare, as opposed to just being an officer, right? So there's the saying, there's those who have, there's those who will. You know, I have fratted in my time, you know, so it was on an ACM sortie. It was for my flight lead upgrade at Shaw. We were me and my IP, my instructor pilot. We were slaying. I mean, it was air combat maneuvering by the numbers, like a 2VX, if you will, within visual maneuvering, kind of Top Gun esque-ish. And I'm obviously better looking. And at the very end, had a system glitch to where I knew who was who. When I pickled, the FCR transitioned who the target was. And airborne, I said, 2-1, I just shot you. And he's like, safe him up, let's go home. And you go home and you take a look at that. And could we have done some different things? Yes, no, maybe so. Some frats are more egregious than others. But at the end of the day, you walked out of that debrief and I shot down a blue fighter. His wife, his kids, gone. And that's a significant mistake. I also got my call sign blitz from a couple tactical mistakes. If we have time for that, we can get into that. But they're rushing me out the door to go deploy to meet my unit as we just had our number one. It was crazy. But those are kind of the mistakes you see on the front end. What I have been fortunate enough in the units I've been in and the personnel that have been with me, I mean, me and Apollo Allen from the Sixers are playing in the same fantasy football league from 2011. And all these bros, half the bros are retired or separated, and we're still in that. And that goes back to the people thing. So all the units I've been in, I've been fortunate enough. But you do hear some units to where maybe you have some honor problems, to where people get pretty defensive, like, oh, I didn't do that airborne. And then you look at the tapes, like, ah, actually, you did, yeah, you know, so... Me and Apollo were brought up earlier that you just own your mistakes. And so initially I'd say my tactical mistakes are, you know, probably similar to everyone else's, but that's kind of where I learned to stand up and say, own them, get better, dust your boots off and get better the very next player the very next day. Stepping into command now, I'm excited and honestly terrified to see what sort of issues are going to raise their ugly heads. You know, and being the Tomahawk DO before I left, it was, let's just make sure that we have a 10 turn 8 and we can get the lines for the students and iron maintenance. Now it's people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I said earlier, to where flying got me interested in the Air Force, people get me to stay. And so now the coolest thing in the world is someone brings you maybe a personal issue and you try to figure out, okay, how do we tackle this together? How do we either generate an institutional answer or a squadron level answer that fixes the glitch for you, type of thing? And then the biggest challenge so far is trying to manage. Someone comes in and maybe unloads a whole lot of baggage. The next person in is talking about really happy news, yeah, and trying to keep yourself on an even keel to make sure that whenever someone brings you bad news or you generate your own bad news, that you don't take it out on somebody else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I think from the mistake perspective, I'll bet over the next couple of years, I'll have a fair amount of examples for you from my time in command, because they've kind of given the guy who has no idea what he's doing the keys to the bus. We'll see what happens. But I, just learning through other people, I think has been awesome. And you probably have a whole series of these things lined up to where things that you learn in the field actually do translate at the universal level out to just being an officer. So a lot of words, I guess, to put a bow on it. Early on in my career is a whole lot of how am I doing from the flying perspective. Now what I've been trying to counsel the tribe on down the Tomahawks and stuff is we got three circles we got to look at. The first is your flying circle. What do you want to do, or what do you want to be from just a pure aviation perspective? The second would be, what do you want to do from a professional perspective? Everything that's outside of flying. What is it to be an Air Force officer? What is it to be an Air Force leader? What professional opportunities do you want in the future? And then lastly, most important, is that family circle. What are you doing to take care of mama and the minions at home? Yourself, faith, family, fitness, you know, and for me, faith, family, fitness, flying, in that order. And then where those three circles overlap in that Venn diagram, then that's where we put our energy. And so early on, it was a whole lot of flying, not a whole lot of care professionally, and hopefully I was taking care of the family. I think we found a whole lot of balance here recently, which is great for everybody.
Well, I think that Venn diagram kind of moves.
It does.
It's not a solid thing, and it just stays there.
That's right.
There is a time where, you know, that circle encompasses a bit more.
That's right.
You know, I think that's valid, because when you're, you know, a fairly new pilot or whatever you're doing, you know, it is your job to learn the job. You have to become tactically proficient or technically proficient in that skill set and those jobs. And that is your priority, at least as far as the Air Force is concerned. And then as you get that experience and as you fleet up, whether it's fleeting up in rank or just fleeting up in experience themselves, I think that's when things start to shift. And that now, because I wasn't worried about people's professional development or development of careers when I was a senior airman staff sergeant.
You were trying to stay alive and do the mission.
Right. I'm just trying to be the best controller that I could possibly be.
That's right. And a damn good one, obviously.
there's some people that would argue, and maybe some stuff in my records that may refute that. But, but now, for sure, my development is almost non-existent. And what I mean is like that professional, and not that, hey, I've made it, but it's like, it's not about me. I've got to make sure that everybody else that is coming behind me, that is just waiting for me to get out of here, is ready to go. Especially when we start talking about, you know, future fights and stuff. And we got to make sure that folks aren't distracted and that they are in fact ready to roll when it happens.
So that was interesting, because again, military service skipped a generation. My wife is actually Canadian. Don't worry, it's on all the security paperwork I have to submit. But you know, there's my parents were relatively in tune with what my daily activities were when I was younger in the squadron and stuff. But my in-laws didn't necessarily understand what was going on. And it was to explain someone who doesn't know what's going on, it's like, well, I fly, which is only like an hour of the day. Then the other 11 hours are either briefing or debriefing. What about the days you don't fly? Well, I'm in the vault studying for 12 hours. And then I go home right at pilot rest to make sure I can show up the next day and fly an airplane. And to your point, like, there's not a whole lot of time, because if you want to come, you know, bombs on target on time, come home alive, it takes a significant amount of work and study to do that. But now we're getting to the regime. As you get older, as I become more veteran, older veteran.
Seasoned.
That's right. Just grizzled. Woody Hayes said it. You win with people. And it's true. We are probably on our way to losing competitive advantages, technologically speaking. But we better win with people. And if we're not taking care of ourselves and taking care of the people in our units, then we're going to have a problem in about 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. I literally just had this conversation. I think it was with the new command chief, Tricky.
Yeah.
Talking about, you know, training and retention and recruitment and stuff like that. And I told him I would take 10 highly motivated, just incredible work ethic, honest, hardworking folks that are highly trained, just 10 of them, as opposed to and throw them at a problem than to have 30 or 40 people that are just here to collect a paycheck.
Or even just one who's super talented
that's
here just to collect a paycheck. Right? I mean, at the end of the day, hard work does matter. The only way you're going to generate hard work over time is if people care.
Yep.
And that's it, right? Yep. So you said earlier, F-16 is the blue collar lunch pail. That is what I hope we have in our unit. But that's what we need to have as an institution. Just bring your lunch pail up and go as hard as you can go every day.
Well, I mean, just the, you know, I know nobody, everybody's on camera. They're like, why is he pointing? But, you know, the folks that are out here, and this includes everybody at the Weapons School and other incredible institutions. But, I mean, these folks out here are day in and day out busting their ass to not just make sure that things are right for the Warfare Center, for the wing, for Colonel Fallon, but then all the rest of the Weapons School commanders, you know, all 21 of them, and then they are still instructing.
That's right.
They are still flying, still instructing on top of that. That's, you can't be the type of person that just shows up and collects a paycheck and work up here.
And they expect the folks in the front office who get that quarter inch of leather around their shield to show up and execute as though they are in the squadron 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week that they just can't even generate because they're up here doing the Lord's work in a different regime. But when it's from fights on to knock it off, everyone's expecting them to perform just as well as their compatriots.
No, exactly.
Which that's pressure.
Mm-hmm.
That I always tell our students that the moment you get to put that shield on your arm, your worst day better be better than everyone else's best day every day. Yeah. That's pressure.
Yeah.
That is pressure. And it's not to say you can't reach out and have help, but professionally speaking, you better be the best in your unit. And if not, you better be trying to be.
Yeah.
That's heavy lays a crown.
It's tough. And just to clarify for folks that are out there, when you're talking about the you know, cloth around the shield, you're talking about being a black boarder, which
that's right.
For the folks out there, if you're a black boarder, that means you're an instructor or have instructed
that's right.
at the weapons school. So not everybody that gets to go through that graduates comes back and instructs, whether it's they're just you know, somewhere in their career and they just missed the kind of window,
the
opportunity
timing,
to come back.
Yeah.
A lot of it's timing. So, but that's what that is.
Yeah.
Sorry so awesome. That. Yeah. When we do these, I try and explain things and I try so hard not to use acronyms.
Yeah.
But it is so tough. And then I catch myself. I will try and say out what an acronym is and I'll mess it up.
We'll have to go back and just dub that out. It'll be fine. It'll be fine.
It's so
it'll
bad.
Buff out. Yeah.
So we already hit some of the mistakes that you said. Yeah. What are some of the good things then?
Yeah.
Because I definitely don't want to be a negative Nancy. I want to highlight some of the good things that you have either done or you have seen.
You bet.
And I mean, you got a one hell of a freaking talented pool over there with the Tomahawks.
We're blessed.
So, like, you know.
So it is, and again, this is tactics transcending to the strategic or even just day-to-day. And that would be, when you see four F-16s go out and they're operating across 20 miles, and like we said, the F-16's so daggone small, you get outside 3, 4, 5 miles, you can't even see them.
No.
But, you know, we have a God's eye view via some data link and stuff like that. This is about where they are. When you see four, or even eight, which is kind of what we're doing right now, go out and with minimal to no communication, put their radars where they're supposed to be, execute their climb profile where they're supposed to be, shoot on time when they're supposed to shoot, and all go out on time. And we do this across 20 to 40 miles, and everything happens like almost at the same time. That's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
That's 4 to 8 different people that are executing at the most optimum level, understand the game plan, and move out. And the way I would kind of put that in the context of just being an officer or being an airman is, you know, doing all that stuff on time, that's called commander's intent. At the tactical level, this is like when I want you to shoot and go out. At the strategic level, this is where I want you to go and prepare to achieve local air superiority in country X, Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm.
Go out and do. And then you have the personnel at the tactical level, or in this case, the units, that know exactly what they're supposed to do, what they're good at, what they're bad at, how to shore up limitations, how to lean on their strengths, and then they do it, and it almost looks like a symphony. It is like watching the most beautifully executed football play without any commentary.
Yep.
And it just looks like poetry on grass.
That's how it was supposed to go. Like, wow, it couldn't have gone any better.
So that is awesome because I don't anticipate we're going to have a fair amount or even any personnel issues because you're working with such a high caliber of people that you just get to sit back and press play and just, man, those folks are doing that. You know, we're at 12 or 13 to 20 on the unit manning document right now. So we should have like 6 or 7 more people than we have. All the ancillary stuff still goes on in the squadron. And I still see the squadron, one foot in front of the other, building 8 to 10 weapons officers that year. That's the most impressive thing, is just to see them put their shoulder to the wheel, relentless effort, and swing as hard as they possibly can for the Tomahawk that's standing next to them. That is awesome. Yeah. And that's what we want the service to be. Whether or not it is, that's open for debate. But I know we have it right here in the 16th, and I know Colonel Fallon has it here in the weapons school.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's definitely a lot easier to, you know, kind of tamp in a flame.
That's right.
A little bit.
That's right.
But keep it going, but kind of tamp in a flame, then try and start a flame.
That's right.
From scratch. So
sometimes you have a little, the guide rails in there, like, but more often not this place. We're a pretty blessed as the command element.
But I mean, that whole commander's intent is about trust and
that's
empowerment.
Right. That's right.
And creating an environment that they feel, I hate using this word, but they feel safe to be able to make a mistake in.
That's
and
right.
Know that they're not going to, like, okay, you make an egregious mistake that could have been mitigated or could have avoided, you know, whether it was unethical, immoral. Okay, that's something completely. I'm talking about, hey, you know, we were doing agile combat employment.
That's right.
We're landing at very remote places with minimal maintenance packages, and we happen to get a little close to something, and we hit just scratch some paint.
Wasn't well lit, you know, just trying to meet the intent.
Okay, so that's going to happen, especially if we're pushing the limits, and maintenance doesn't need to get in trouble for that. The pilot doesn't need to get in trouble with that. It's like, okay, this is the cost of doing business, and okay, cool, like noted. Now let's mark that with some chem lights or whatever we got to do. Yep. Chop it down, and then
get it repaired, and we're launching the So you know, average college football game, you're going to see 72, 73 plays. I've never seen a single game yet where all 72 or 73 of those plays are perfectly executed. Hmm. Same thing here. Now there might be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 key plays in a game. Certainly that you can point to and say, well, you know, the ball bounces this way, or if we don't miss this block, or if we seal that back, or whatever. Sure, maybe you spring one for 6 or you get the first down. But there were, you know, 70 or 69 or 68 more plays around that if you execute maybe a little bit better, then maybe the outcome is a little bit different. Same thing here. I've never seen a perfect sortie in my life.
No.
And it doesn't exist.
There is something that can be debriefed and something that can be done better.
That's right. And so, you know, Tim Kite and Brian Kite, who run Focus 3 out of Columbus, Ohio, actually, as it turns out, talk about leadership, culture, and behavior. And they've had Urban Meyer on there a few times. And I would, you know, you can talk about Urban in a lot of different lights. From a professional competitive perspective in coaching, Nick Saban's probably the only one that's better than him. Hopefully Ryan Day here soon and Troy Calhoun up at Air Force. Obviously, Coach Barry's pretty good too. But he's made the claim a few times. And as I knew I was getting blessed to have this opportunity to be Tomahawk 1, you start to evaluate what sort of leadership would you like to enact? What sort of leader are you? Blah, 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 right? But he said two things, and I can't find a flaw in them. Number one, the leader's responsible for building the culture or enhancing the culture. Right, and that's what you believe, how you behave, and the outcomes you deliver. The second thing is acquiring and developing talent, which is people, culture and people, those two things. Everything else will take care of itself, particularly in our unit. Yeah. We're here at the weapons school writ large, right? So you will not have an effective unit if the culture is, I'm afraid I'm going to make a mistake, or I'm afraid the boss is looking at me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not going to say I'm doing it right. You could probably talk to all the Tomahawks in here, and they might be throwing spears like you read about. You know what I mean? Yeah. But all I've asked of those folks down there is relentless effort. Be better today than yesterday, and be professional in everything you do. Those three things. That's the culture.
Well, it's important because people are watching.
That's right.
Whether they know online that, hey, I'm still active duty, or they see you, whether you're on base or off base, and they see you wearing a flight suit, and then, okay, well, they find out, now you're a Viper driver.
Yeah.
Now there's this. Now, you know, so when you, at all times, you are representing, you know, your community, whether that's your church, your family.
That's right.
You know, your immediate family, your you know, parents and extended family. You're representing the weapons school, you're representing the Viper community, and on and on, and it's important because people are watching.
No,
people expect a lot out of you know,
that's right,
in uniform.
And right, wrong, or indifferent, that expectation is always there. And that's where I was very blessed growing up. You know, mom and dad love them to death, and big brother, hey, you wear our name on the back of your shirt. And then that kind of resonates. And then our large Irish Italian Catholic family, my mom's side, same thing on my dad's side. And I mean, there's almost hundreds of us, you know. Hey, you represent us when you go out in the world. Same thing here, you know, and so we're one of the few units that will give the squadron patch to give to our students. And so from day one at weapons school, they're Tomahawks. The students here are going through the crucible. And every phase brief that we have, that's what we end with, is you wear the shield on your right arm, the squadron logo. So anytime that we have a slip up, particularly when it comes to professionalism or effort or being lazy and not getting better today than you were yesterday, then that's a chink out of our armor too. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the people that have come through here, 886 F-16 weapons school graduates since
1982. 886?
Since 1982. That's right. So we are standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, all of us.
Right? And we have a tracker, actually, that goes all the way back to patch number one. Through. So, you know, you go look, say, oh, Blitz Norman's patch number 740. I'm just a person. The legacy of that unit is the convergence of the effort and outcome of 886 people.
Wow.
To include a couple of chiefs of staff.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, you've got CQ Brown is a Viper. I think he was a career Viper guy too.
Sure was.
Yeah,
General Goldfein before him. Mm-hmm. So, and that's not to say that, you know, pulling rank and all that stuff is the most significant thing. But with great power comes great responsibility, and you earn the shield that you wear on your left arm. You're going to be given some opportunity because the expectation's so daggone high, you know. And that comes back to, again, just getting to see the machine execute. And just kind of sit back and just be impressed by it. It's eye-watering.
Humbling.
It is. Sometimes you walk in and say, am I good enough to walk in this organization and lead it?
Which is very daunting because that is a real thing. Especially during WISN. Yeah, you know, because that's really when we come together. Yeah, we've got, you know, core one, core two, yep. in three and stuff. But like, I'm not really seeing the execution part of it. But when you see as an institution where you've got global strike assets, mobility command assets, space assets, AFSOC assets, or Air Force Special Operations,
cyber,
and then you got the Combat Air Force, all of them, you know, and you used the word symphony earlier, but. You know, and it's not without its hiccups and ugly babies and all that kind of stuff.
Reference, like, no perfect sortie, is everybody excuse.
There is some ugliness that happens, but with that ugliness, there's some real beauty in that because you see people going, accepting risk where they can accept risk, mitigating where they can mitigate it, knowing that they have to get uncomfortable and challenge yourself. It really pushed the limit. Not go, oh, well, the Air Force instruction says this. It's like, okay, I'm using that Air Force instruction as a point of departure.
That's right.
And I'm getting after what COMAC's intent is or Commander of Air Combat Command.
That's right.
And what, you know, essentially what POTUS and our nation needs us to get after.
Yeah, and those AFIs and policy are certainly going to be, hey, these are your edge lines on the highway. Mm-hmm. Just drive to Salt Lake or whatever platitude you want to use there, right? But that's 100% valid, and it comes down to all those folks you talked about across the mobility Air Force, the combat Air Force, the bomber Air Force, space, cyber, intel transcends all that. All the assets we have, you're still looking at a subject matter expert from each airframe that get around the planning table, and whatever that person says around that table, the other folks are going to take that as gospel or as the truth. Say, okay, if the Viper guy says that you can do X, Y, and Z, I'm counting on it because I don't have the time nor the expertise to go look it up. Yeah. And that is again, we talk about on your worst days, you got to be better than everyone else's best because lives are at stake. Right now, they don't see it.
No.
You know, because we're here. But at some point, those folks are going to be standing in the mission planning cell, putting together wherever we go next or defending the homeland, take your pick, that everyone is counting on them, bombs on target on time, to come home alive.
That's the kind of heavy weight of it in the way that, like, if they are not ready on night one, wherever that happens to be,
that's right.
Right? And they are not as ready as they could have been, that's on us.
100%. You know, so we talk about the 886 that we've graduated. Again, just absolute champions. There's going to come a point in time in my command, most likely where we don't graduate all the students that we brought in, to where a candidate effectively washes out, or student washes out, doesn't meet the performance bar. The first thing that we're going to do is pull ourselves together and say, what did we not do as an instructor cadre to make sure that this individual could have met the bar? Did we do everything that we could do? And that's where it's got to start first, because again, at the end is when we kick them out the door and we put the shield on their left arm and they are a patch, a weapons officer, well, they're going to be off and running, because they're going to become the liaison to our most senior leaders to give them the pure truth. They're going to be the liaisons to the director of operations, say, hey, this is what our turn, and they're going to be the conduit into the squadrons and stuff like that. And so it's, again, 886. Hopefully to be 894 here soon.
Yeah, yeah. So, as we're rapidly approaching graduation.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right.
So I spoke to Bain yesterday, right? You know, he's a Strike Eagle pilot, so they've got a crew of two. Yep. We started talking about the kind of team mentality and that camaraderie. So how does that play in with, you know, you as a single ship, or a one-seater, a single-seater? How does that play into you? Because I know that you guys have a team mentality, especially when you start talking about a, you know, 8V8 or whatever kind of formation you're doing. But dive into that if you
can.
How's that teaming kind of work
for you guys? It is funny you ask that, because on the last sortie that we executed here, really one of the biggest points was that our student that was on the point didn't put a hat on a hat. And again, having played at Air Force, my brother played at ISA, I love football analogies. I also think there's a whole lot of good analogies that come from sports into life, particularly football into life, right? So hat on a hat. So the scenario was where we had our 8 F-16s, there was an air threat and there were surface threats. Then there were targets that we had to bomb. Well, we knew about these air threats and we knew about these surface threats and we knew about the target we needed to bomb for about 100 miles. Now, for those in the audience, when you're traveling at about 8 to 9 miles a minute, 100 miles goes by pretty fast, as it turns out, right? So like when we talk about delayed decision making, it's not as delayed as you think, because those miles are just clicking down like that. But what we failed to do as the number one in this formation, he failed to get someone in his foreship or across the 8 ship. I need you to put your radar in the missile into that air threat. Cool. And like that's all that individual would have been focused on. And then you see the threats at range. Hey, I want you to put your sensors onto this threat. And then if you need to employ an AGM-88, it's a HARM. It's like what we shot back in Vietnam. Now we have kind of a modern version of it. I need you to do that. And then you need to put a bomb on that target. If we would have doled out those responsibilities, getting a hat on a hat, you know, getting offender for every defender or vice versa, then we're going to be okay. And that's that teamwork piece. And then everyone knows, okay, Blitz is going to shoot a missile at that air threat. He's got it. And when it doesn't happen,
like, hey, dude,
then it all goes sideways.
Yeah.
You know, now, I mean, that's like the left tackle missing a block. And then your scholarship quarterback's laying in the dirt, probably injured.
Sorry.
So I guess I'm not going to training table. Yeah. So that's the concept. Another good one that you'd be familiar with is whenever we fly close air support, you know, and we take off a Nellis and we fly just 30 miles up the road to the range, just over the mountain there, like Uncle Rico, just over the mountain. We will kick off, because we usually fly CAS or close air support as two ships, so two of us. We'll kick off number two to go to change his radios to listen to what's going on in the area of operations. And so number one might be talking to air traffic control, like we talked about, hey, where do I need to go, da, 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 da. Whereas number two or someone else in the formation is building situational awareness inside the fight. And then whenever number one comes over and says, hey, what's going on, he expects that information to be rock solid and 100% accurate and as passed from you on the ground. And if it's not, then we're going to be operating on an incomplete picture. The airborne assets are thinking, well, I thought it was this. No, well, that's not what I told you. And it comes down because the teammate did not.
Yeah.
Classic telephone game.
Well, so the JTAC owns some of that too. Hey, I mean, hey, I appreciate that, but the JTAC certainly owns it. Like we tell people, when you're getting that situation up, you've got to build a picture. Sure, there's essentially a checklist and abbreviation that we follow, or not abbreviation, acronym that we follow, but it does you and it does me no favors if I don't paint a solid and complete picture for you to the best of my ability. Obviously, if we're troops in contact, I'm going to give you an abbreviated free situation update. We're going to get you on target because I just need you. But if given the time, I need to be doing what I need to do to help, you know, Team America or Team Coalition, you know, because we have other players that are out there.
Or allies. But now I will say, I've never been let down by the trench. So
Well, the trench is something special too. You talk about the tomahawks, the trench is something special too. Having, you know, my having some roots in there.
That's right.
But it translates across so many different, every single whips that we have, or weapon squadron that we have here. And it also translates to so many of the different organizations that we have in the Air Force. And it's important to just, and I know this seems like it's going to be a love fest to everybody because we're just, you know, we're not shitting on anybody.
Well,
which we could do.
Well, then let's do that. So if we're talking about teamwork and synergy, here'd be my question for maybe our senior leaders is, do you think that our directorates at the directorate level talk well and play well with one another? Does my A1 know what's going on, the A2 know what's going on, the A3 know what's going on, the A4 and the A589? And then if they do, how is everyone up on high putting those pieces together? Mm-hmm. Right? Because again, it's no different than we take our 8 ship and none of us are on the same page and then everything goes sideways from jump, right? So it certainly does transcend. And that I think would be an interesting topic is, hey, A3, what personnel decisions have been made at the A1 level and how's that going to affect the middle 10 years as an example?
No, you're 100% right. And like, if, believe me, given the opportunity, if I could talk to a General Slive, a General Bauerfine, you know, hell, even COMAC, General Kelly, you know, I would love to have them on and just, I mean, we just left a meeting with General Kelly and every time he comes here, I write something down in my notebook that he said, because he has what's called his call sign's Grace.
He's got
the Grace-isms.
That's right.
And every time he comes here and he talks, I'm like, ooh, that's
pretty good.
That's really good.
Let me write that down.
Did you practice that, or did you just come off, you know?
Is that your speechwriter?
Like, yeah, did you just wing that?
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd love to have them on just to go, because, again, I am sure that there are variables to every single one of the very complex and very massive decisions they are making and problems that they are trying to solve. But when you're down at, whether it's, you know, a lower level, like where we're at, or folks that are looking to come in, or everything that you see on the news or social media, it's like, and by no means would I ever expect any of our general officers, they owe me nothing. They do not have to come out and say and message.
That's right.
Hey, that's what, like, we pay you a bunch of money and give you authorities to be able to make those decisions. But as feedback is, it would help your services to be a little bit more transparent and do a little bit better messaging. And I don't mean from a public affairs messaging.
That's right.
I mean, like, hey, next time you're at Nellis and we have an all call, don't expect me or any of the other airmen or NCOs, officers or whatever to ask the question. I want you to come out and you go, hey, listen, I know that there's been some heartache about this. Let me go ahead and address it now.
Yeah, that's right.
This is why we did this.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if not, we're just left to our own devices to like kind of spin in our brain and come up with our own.
Which we certainly need to measure that ourselves too, right?
For sure.
But I think I'd probably even go left of that. So we talk about here in integration, when we bring all 21 squadrons or whatever it is together and execute the biggest mission, inevitably, one of the debrief points, probably multiple sorties, will be, well, there is a piece of data that space or cyber found that then Intel was able to get their arms around, that then went into the chat room, that then went up to TAC-C2 or the command and control folks, that then went over here and part of it made it out to the fighters that were airborne or to the JASM shooter, to the long-range missile shooters, whatever, and say, well, why did that break down? And then we spend 4 hours to 10 hours debriefing how one piece of data, how one coordinate, one northing, one whatever, didn't make it through 16 wickets to execute the mission. And we spend that time debriefing and say, this is how we're going to do better. I would be curious to know if when we make institutional decisions, is there a debrief process on the backside of that? Because their bandwidth is so large. I mean, again, our senior leaders do a fantastic job, but they're dealing with a whole lot of problems at the same time. They're only getting the information that their staff's telling them. Their staff's trying to do the very best to give them the information that they think that they need or that they want. I mean, so there's a whole myriad of reasons about maybe why senior leaders make decisions today. But the question is, do they debrief their decisions?
I don't know. And I would
and the mechanics behind it. Yeah. Not only this is what we decided, but this is how we decided.
I'd like to say yes, but having gone on a staff, and I know that you've worked on the staff because you said something very in particular. What is their staff telling them? So I also worked on a staff, and for the folks, that don't know, commanders, whether they're squadron commanders or they're half or whatever it is, their comac, their decisions are only as good as the information that they are provided, and when they can't possibly take in all the information that's coming, so they rely on their staff. And if their staff has an agenda that doesn't align with that commander, then there's a misalignment, and they may not be getting all the information that they need. And it sounds really bad because you're like, well, the commander, that is the commander, and he is trying to push an agenda, or agenda. And I know that sounds bad, but they are trying to make positive changes within an organization to advance an organization, and now it's moving as fast as the staff will allow it to.
Yeah, which I mean, we could unpack this for like the next 10 days, but you figure 15th Air Force is just a numbered Air Force inside of ACC. 15th Air Force is 49,000 people strong. ACC, I want to say, is on the order of like 100,000-ish people, somewhere around there.
Probably sounds about right, because SOCOM's right around 73 or 80, something like that.
So you're asking for one person, the major command commander, in this case, General Kelly, or take your pick across any of the major commands, that has to know what's going on across the directorates that some of your listeners may not be aware of, right? Personnel, the A1. Intel, the A2. Operations, the A3. Logistics sustainment, A4. Right? Plans, A5. Cyber, A6, integration exercise, A7, future requirement at whatever, A8, A9, and then Nuke, A10. And
each one of those has subdirectorates.
That's right.
You have, 3-5, 3-7.
So you're looking at the MAGCOM commander to be able to corral 15-ish people, call it 16 for the Tomahawks, chop to that, 16 people, and get their opinion across a 24-hour day. Yeah. That's tough. And then those directors then, hundreds to to thousands to tens of thousands of people that are reporting to them. And you might honestly run into just a transmission problem from the staffs that are working problems all the way up through that chain. Again, where did that piece of data get lost? Right? It could have been at the major lieutenant colonel working the staff, or it could have been the director, or it could have been the four-star. Who knows? You also might run into a capacity problem. Not everyone we have in this Air Force are champions.
No.
And I might be one of the ones that is not a champion. Right? So you might have those folks that are just jobbing it. They're just making really bad decisions because they don't understand.
Yeah.
Or they don't have the capacity. So there's a myriad of reasons. That's why I'm interested in what's the mechanics of their debrief when an institutional decision is made. Yeah. And then what's the analysis of did we make the right one?
Yeah. And I fully acknowledge, and I didn't mean to, but I definitely painted the staff in a bad light. They're obviously great people doing work on there, but it is...
Well, I mean,
There is a narrative, the staff is able to shape the narrative.
That's right. However, so the staff is the staff. It's just nameless, faceless person, right? But we all have bros on the staff. We've all been on the staff. So we know there are pipe hitters. We also know the staff actually is wildly undermanned too.
Oh, yeah. So when we talk about that enormity of problems that they're trying to solve.
That's right.
People think that the staff, and I'd be interested to see what POTUS's staff is.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Because everybody talks about, their staff, but, you think that this staff is just these hundreds and hundreds of people. No.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a handful.
Who are you representing? Well, I'm one person representing 10, because I'm supposed to have 9 more with me, but they're not here.
But they're not. Yeah. And they're not coming.
That's right. Cavalry's not showing up.
No.
Ain't showing up.
No.
So I guess that's where I would, if I got to go back in a room with Comac again, that would be the one question I'd ask him.
Yeah.
What's our senior leader debrief process look like?
Well, it's kind of weird too, because you go to a room like we were in, and we had 30 or 40 people in there, all commanders, 06, 05s. You had some, handful of chiefs, and you had some master sergeants, senior master sergeants in there, and General Kelly's holding court and answering questions. Maybe too large. The great thing about General Kelly is he is He is very transparent.
And very personable.
Very personable, very transparent. Super smart, too. And he will tell you exactly kind of the conversations that are being had and that kind of stuff. Now, I think that changes as soon as he leaves that door and he's got to broadcast to a wider audience.
That's right.
But I would love to even narrow that down even more to just get, okay, copy, you're Carmack, you're General Kelly, but right now you're Grace. Or you know.
Well,
and
so.
I'm Peaches. Let's freaking talk.
So is your audience read into the debrief process?
No. Yeah. I mean, they know about debrief, and you get all the meme pages that, hey, yeah, weapons officers debrief for
you know,
4 hours at a minimum kind of thing.
But the mechanics of it, though, to where you just close the door, there is no rank in the debrief. Blitz and Peaches or Grace and Peaches, right? And it's, you know, if flying's done and you want to partake, there might be a libation or two that's in there, right? But it is, let's just learn. Let's get to brass tacks. And there's no veneer. It is, let's rip the Band-Aid off and let's see what we can do better. But as soon as the door opens, it's, you know, hey, it's just General Kelly, and then it's Peaches, and then we're off and running. So, but I agree. You almost wonder if, like, the staff or, like, those decision makers should have whiskey time. So, like, at 1600 on Thursdays, we will close the door, and I'll have my trusted agents. And then it's just, I just listen. You guys talk.
Yeah, and you know, he just mentioned dissent. That's hugely important because,
that's right,
you know, you do get, you know, a senior leader, probably not for us now because, you know, we've just been around enough of them, but senior leaders can be intimidating just because whether it's the positional power they have or it's just like, holy cow, I've never seen a 4-star, or I've never seen Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, like, oh my God, you know?
I think that's probably part of it is that rarity. Mm-hmm. You know, because everyone sees, you know, here specifically, everyone sees a weapons school IP. Everyone's the same.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden you go out to the field to a base that maybe doesn't have but one previous weapons school IP. Everyone's kind of like, hey,
maybe look at so-and-so over there. Yeah.
maybe we should go learn from that person. You know, same thing. Like how often do you see a 4-star or a 3-star or 2-star in your day? Unless you are that close to them on the staff. And that, so I think it's that rarity piece probably that maybe put some folks on their heels. But I haven't seen a significant issue with that from our perspective. You know, I think any Tomahawk would feel comfortable just walking up and talking to
him. For sure. You know, and I think that's important. You should feel that comfortable. Absolutely. Well, we're rapidly approaching an hour, which is what I got to give you some time back. But before we go and we close out, I want to ask you one final question, and that's in terms of advice.
Yeah.
Like because our demographic, and I'll give you a chance to think, I'll talk through this real quick. Yeah. Our demographic is, 15 to 35, anywhere, high school, college, folks that are out there, some of which want to join the Air Force and the DOD, some of which are just like, hey, this is just, you know, whatever. I mean, in reality, there's only 10 people that listen to this podcast, like my parents, Aaron's parents, Trent's parents. That's really about it.
And now the Normans. And now the Normans.
Yeah, the Blitz family. But you know, some of them want to know, like, what just piece of advice. And what's amazing is that everybody kind of has their kind of different take.
Yeah.
On it. So I'd just be interested to see what you would kind of advise to the to those folks that are out there. We'll just call it looking to join.
So probably two pieces, if that's okay. The first I'd say is discernment. I don't think we do a whole lot of good in our culture, just the way everything is the speed of heat and I need everything now, like my pizza's not here, like I don't have Wi-Fi. How about some discernment? Just take some time. You know, for me personally, I'd be going to the church and praying in front of the Holy Sacrament and just hoping that the Holy Spirit, you know, gives me the guidance that I need. Because at the end of the day, it's not what does Blitz want to do, it's what does God want me to do, quite honestly. If that's not down your alley, I still think that there needs to be a level of discernment. You can't make the decision under duress, because if you do, it's likely the incorrect decision. Mm-hmm. But then once you've discerned or you've decided to make the decision that this is maybe something that you want to do, then it's you have to figure out a way to win the day. Doesn't matter what it is. It might be as simple as I got up and I made my bed. It might be as long as, well, I got up and I did pretty well on this PT thing. I did pretty well in terms of my uniform and basic training and marching the whole nine, whatever. You know, and that's what we tell all our students to show up. That's what I tell the instructors too. Today is not going to be your best day. Now, like I said, hopefully your worst day is better than everyone else's best day. Don't mean it's a great day for you, though, personally. you're going to have a fair amount of losses. And if we get caught up around the axle of looking at what we did not do well today, that can be terrible if we don't take our wins away out of it. Because then all of a sudden you become demoralized. You know, it's that team that's, you know, has 2 minutes to go, is down three and needs to go 80 yards for a score, or maybe down four, whatever. And you come out and you get a false start. You get behind the chains. And then come out and then you get an unsportsmanlike, and then all of a sudden it's like first and 35.
Like, great.
Yeah, and it snowballs. And you got to figure out a way to figure out, what did I do well today? And what do I want to repeat? And those things I didn't do well, how do I win that tomorrow? And I think that if you discern, that you figure out this is where I'm supposed to be, and then you show up knowing that you're good enough, depending on what phase of training you're in, ain't ever going to be good enough. Just like you come here, we're going to find something we're going to spend a whole lot of time talking about. You might not pass your ride that day, but there's rides that you pass that you think you shouldn't, and there's rides that you don't pass that you think you should. Don't care about the scoreboard. We'll tell you when to worry about the scoreboard. Until then, let's just worry about, what did I do well today? Can I do it again tomorrow? And then it's one or two things that I didn't do well today, I can do tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So discernment and just winning the day, I think those are probably two big chunks of what I would encourage. And that's what I'm going to tell my kids too. Whenever the 12-year-old Anthony Jr. or Amelia or Matthew or Michael, you know, are starting to think about, what do you want to do? Well, here you go.
Here's the gauntlet. Go for it.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Because anything worth doing ain't easy.
No.
It's not.
Nope, not at all.
So wake up and do something and know that you're probably going to get hit in the mouth, either literally or figuratively, and then just keep swinging as hard as you possibly can. Get a breakthrough, win that day, and just as what we'd say, be a four. Just be professional in everything you do.
Yeah.
And just put it on repeat from here to eternity. Let's go.
I'm with it.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. I know you couldn't find anybody else. I just keep falling through the cracks, so it's perfect. But truly honored and humble that you'd even ask me to do this, so thank you.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that everybody has something good to provide. And even if, you know, we go through 30 guests or 30 episodes where everybody's just like, what are we doing here? If somebody can latch on to one thing that somebody says, and it helps carry them in a different direction, or helps carry them for that day, like, that's a win for me.
Yeah.
Like, so. But again, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Yeah. And everybody else, don't forget to like, subscribe, hit that notification bell, and then we'll see you later.